first episode of the Communist Current Podcast. My name is Clara Sorrenti. I'll be your host. And today we're going to talk about communism, the Pride Movement, the history of LGBTI people in the communist movement, as well as our own personal experiences and stories. Before we begin, however, I'd just like to read off a list of our supporters on Patreon to thank them for their support. Ashley Anaya, Basil Baldwin, BDEF, James Phillips, Jeff Carr, Jeff Tomlinson, Jerry Goldberg, John T., Juliana Cohen, Justin Stewart, Kevin Sanders, Moopy, Matthew Fain, Ozren Vukobat, Paul Hoffman, Robert J.L., Ruslan Gainatnevov, Scott Deshanes, Shane Marches, the CYM, and Vivian Jane Horn. Thank you all, comrades. If you're interested in supporting our show, take a look at the page patreon.com/thecommunistcurrent. But now on to the topic at hand. I'd like to introduce my two guests for today, Rowan Morris.
Hello.
And Evelyn Newland. So we're going to go in order and talk a bit about ourselves today. I guess I'll start. Many of you who are listening in today already know who I am. My name's Clara Sorrenti. I help run the Communist Current. I'm an organizer for the Young Communist League in London, Ontario. And I'm actually also the Communist Party candidate for the federal riding of London North Centre in the upcoming October federal elections. I first came out as transgender when I was about 16 years old. I've been involved in various roles in the community since then related to LGBTI people. It's been quite a journey over all those years, and especially since becoming a communist, I'm really excited that we get to have this podcast and we get to talk about the issues that affect us uniquely that we don't necessarily get to hear elsewhere. So I think I'm going to move it over to Rowan.
All right, then. So I'm Rowan. I'm the secretary for the YCL Club here in London. And I am trans, and my pronouns are he, him, and his. I don't know what other information I should be sharing right now.
I guess you're also gay?
Yeah, I'm very gay. It's important to know.
Very gay. Evelyn, you're also gay, right?
I feel like that's a reasonable approximation of I'm Evelyn Newland. I also still go by my name of Everett, like kind of birth name. I don't really consider it a dead name. It's just I use different names. In any case, some people might know me for like a whole lot of shit posting online and also going to pride parades and being like, someone once called me the communist type girl. Basically I'm a member of the YCL London. I am currently in Guelph. I'm kind of just all over the place, and I'm currently doing an MA thesis, I guess, field work for a thesis to do with like sort of stuff to do with transgender experience and communities and stuff like that, although I'm finding that the scope of it keeps increasing and decreasing at different times. That's all a very complicated subject, but in any case, hopefully that's a reasonable approximation of what we're getting at right here.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes sense. So I guess, moving on, if, like, you think we've all done a good job introducing ourselves, I'm sure there's, like, always so much
say. They, them, or she, her pronouns, either.
Yeah, I should have also mentioned I use she, her pronouns. But the second point now, how do you feel about the Pride movement? As I figured that's, given that it's still Pride Month, we've, even as the YCL London, we attended the Stratford Pride Parade. We're going to attend the Pride London Parade. The YCL and CPC in Toronto attended the parades there. I actually joined the Communist Party because the Communist Party of Canada had a booth at World Pride in Toronto. So... for myself, like, I see the Pride movement as a launching pad to get involved in radical activity, even though it's, like, super liberal and not at all, like, its roots.
Right.
So I want to pass it over.
I mean, I kind of just want to hear Evelyn go on about this, because I mostly just have mixed feelings about Pride at this point. It's just irritation and frustration and tired, very tired.
Yeah. Except you do a lot of your research on this, Evelyn. Like, what's your take on the Pride movement today?
Okay, so, like, I don't know if I would even describe it as liberal so much as kind of commodified, like, or at least sort of undergoing a constant process of commodification. I don't think it's possible to fully commodify Pride. It would stop being Pride if it just became 100% this kind of, like, liberalized commodity. But it is definitely, like, it's a target of all kinds of, like, you know, sort of activity that sort of alienates what it does from what its kind of stated purpose is, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm kind of looking at this in a sort of a dialectical way, of course, where it's like basically, you know, what it is doing at this point is a number of different things. You have on one side a very kind of liberalized notion of what Pride is, where it's mostly sort of a celebration of past victories, kind of just like a glorification of sort of individual self-ownership and, you know, sort of freedom of expression and all that kind of thing. And then on the other side, you've got this kind of, this sort of awareness that it's supposed to be political, mm-hmm. this concept of, you know, like Stonewall was a riot, like, you know, 50 years of this, that, the other. So on the one side, there's the kind of liberal aspect of things. And then on the other side, there's this awareness that Pride should be political, or it is political, that Stonewall was a riot, Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, all those, like, icons. Like, people are aware of that kind of political history and will insist upon that being continually relevant today. However, there really, I don't see a whole lot of articulation of what that's supposed to mean in terms of action. And so you've got this kind of thing where what resonates with the community is primarily, like, this kind of expressive, like, you know, liberal form of of Pride. And then on the other side, you've got this awareness that it should be political that doesn't really move.
I saw with the Dyke March this year, they, like, commemorated it to the, what, 50th anniversary of Stonewall? Mm-hmm. Yet, in those parades, you have, like, you know, big corporations, you have banks, in some cases you have military contractors in these parades. And I'm just like, how did they get to a point where we have rainbow banks marching in a parade that's supposed to be dedicated to the anniversary of riots?
Yeah. I went to Toronto Pride once, and it was actually the year that Black Lives Matter stopped the parade, and I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know what was happening at the time, though, because, like, a winner's float, that department store, like, had just stopped in front of us, and we basically just had to stare at the winner's float for, like, an hour, and I had no idea what was going on. Anyway, so that's what Pride is to me. It's overly corporatized. It's just a mess. God. Oh, and afterwards, like, I went up to my Airbnb with my husband after that Pride parade, and we were looking down at the street, and there's just so much trash all over the street, and I'm having to sweep it up afterwards, all this rainbow confetti. So, yeah, Pride just seems very corporatized and wasteful to me at this point.
Yeah. And I definitely, like, agree with that. It's, like, a super wasteful. It's basically just a huge party weekend, whatever it ends up
It's
happening.
A depoliticized party weekend.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, at this point, like, you know, TD Bank at this point will tell you that Pride is political. Like, and they'll do it as a marketing stunt. Like, that said, I don't think that it, again, it, I don't know if I would call it completely depoliticized, and I think that if you get on the ground and see the stuff that's really going on,
It's not. I'm just very disillusioned at this point. You're totally correct, though, that it's not completely depoliticized. I mean, like, we're communists and we're going to be marching.
Right.
Yeah. So
we wouldn't be doing it if we thought it was just, like, a waste of time. And the thing is, you go there, like, anytime I'm there, like, I was just at Toronto Pride, you know, 2 days ago. No, 3 days ago. Sorry. You know, while I was there, we had a lot of very direct support from just bopping around being like, guys, communism, you know, like, and we often will not find that kind of support like anywhere else other than maybe like in certain kinds of labor movements.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can tell you, I went out door knocking for 3 hours last Saturday and, you know, like maybe for every 10 doors I knock on, 2 of them are supportive.
Yeah, right.
You get a lot of people who are like, well, good luck with that. And then they slam the door in your face.
Like, lol, communism.
Yeah, basically.
Right.
I haven't read any communist books, but I've read a book by someone who said he read some books who
said that communism was bad.
Yeah, that's basically the majority of it, I feel like.
I heard communism was bad, and I never critically questioned this.
No, it kills, like, a million peoples, and it's also homophobic, and all that good shit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's why the YCL is absolutely full of gay trans people, is because of how homophobic communism is.
We're all being
brainwashed.
Right?
Yeah,
we're
absolutely.
We're being brainwashed. Like, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, so I understand both of your points, like, Evelyn and Rowan, because Pride is definitely, in a lot of ways, really wasteful and not a good space for political organizing. But then on the other hand, it allows us to, like, get out there and get our message out there, and it's how we've done so much recruiting in London. Because we have that opportunity to hand out, like, thousands of leaflets and have free visibility. Well, I guess not free, because we end up paying to register.
Yeah, there's
but
that.
It's totally worth
it.
Oh,
yeah. Well, I mean, I would even go so far as to say that it actually is a good space for political organizing. It's just that you have to be able to, like, get in contact with the people who are looking to make it, to have a more political presence and all that. And it was funny because actually my housemate was saying after I got back to Guelph, they were looking through the pictures that were posted from the Pride Parade, and they were just like, you know, for one thing that we had a really distinctive presence, but for another thing that it was so obviously not like corporate pride was what they really liked about it, you know. So that really does, like, it resonates with people all over the place, even just sort of like kind of vaguely, you know, people who aren't even that closely involved in any kind of political movements or anything like that. Like, it resonates with people, and it kind of gets people like, you know, maybe something can be done here when we've got a presence along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's also important just for communists to have a presence when there's other political parties present. Otherwise, people don't, they either don't think we exist, or they're under the impression we're so small that we don't matter.
That's a lot of our struggle right now, is just is just showing people that we are, like, visible and continue to be relevant.
Absolutely.
And I think Pride is great for that. I mean, Pride is very loud and visible. That's the entire point of it. So let's be loud and visible. All right, so.
So the next point, why are you a communist? How did you become a communist? So I guess I'll start off with that. So I was always, since I was like 14, influenced by communist ideas. My parents liked to travel a lot. They took me when I was like 13 to a resort on Cuba. And they had English language copies of Grandma International. So, you know, being the antisocial kid I was, though I ended up becoming quite a social person after I came out as trans. I found, like, before that, I just did not care about other people. you know, you have a lot of issues to work out for yourself sometimes before you can, like, get to a point where you care about other people.
It's true.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately.
Going back to the topic, I found an article written by Fidel, because he used to have a section that was, like, his own blog in the newspaper. It was called Reflections of Fidel. And he was talking, this was about the time the Paris Climate Accord happened, so he was talking about how capitalism has unsustainably ravaged the planet, and how even the attempts to limit carbon emissions were unsustainable. Like, they weren't even trying. Scientists were saying, we need it this low, and they're like, nah, how about this low? Mm. I raised my hand, you can't see it, but... from there, I just always had more sympathy to communist ideas and communist figures. And then, come around 2016, 2017, Trump was elected. And then the week following, Alexandre Bissonnette massacred a mosque in Quebec City. And that really hit me to see how, because Bissonnette was a Trump supporter, mm-hmm. there was a photo of him in a MAGA hat, and seeing that connection and seeing how unstable politics had become, that a U.S. president could directly influence someone to massacre people in a foreign country. I was like, okay, you know what? Why should I be ashamed to be a communist? Things are way more fucked up than they need to be right now. Yeah. Right. But yeah, that was about it. Then I joined the CPC, and I helped form the YCL Club in London.
Cool. I think, Rowan, it's your turn.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so why I'm a communist, pretty much I feel like it's a life or death situation, in the sense that, yes, climate change is happening, it's happening fast, and capitalism is the cause of most of our climate catastrophe, capitalism and colonialism, so I feel like a properly decolonial communist movement in Canada is the best way to... weather the storms of climate change, because it's going to be bad, so we need to build resilient communities to survive it, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I look at the political situation in Canada, and I see that the Communist Party has the absolute best plan going forward for dealing with all of this. So I was originally kind of like a vaguely liberal person. Mm-hmm. I voted NDP. I was kind of involved with some Trotskyists for a bit. When the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, they released that report in the fall of 2018, that really hit me hard. We have basically 12 years left, and even less than that when you look at the, like, loss of biodiversity and how that's going to affect human populations, too. So, yeah, I just feel like we need to get more political now.
Oh, absolutely.
There's no way around it.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, Evelyn, why did you become a communist?
So for my part, like, first off, I became a communist, I guess. In one form or another, I've been a communist for, like, I would say around 10 years, and easily before I figured out all my gender shit. So, like, at the time, I was, like, you know, another, like, you know, cisgender, heterosexual, white male kind of thing. But anyway, the big point was that, like, I think that throughout my entire life I'd had some kind of, like, an interest in, like, anti-oppressive politics, because it's, like, you know, looking at all the stupid shit that's happened over the course of human history, and especially since, like, you know, the dawn of the 20th century, in terms of, like, just, like, all these matters of oppression, I kind of, like, wanted for a very long time to figure out, like, you know, why do people do shit like this? Why are people, you know, all these... And I never really found, like, this idea that it's just sort of, like, somebody's bad, like, inclinations, you know, someone's bad attitude that, like, white supremacy is just sort of, like, a personal flaw or whatever, particularly compelling. And the thing is that, like, with Marxism, I found not only, like, kind of an idea of, like, why do these things emerge, but also what can be done about it. And I think that a lot of it also comes back to that, like, one sort of Leslie Feinberg quote that I ended up making a meme out of before about how, like, you know, Marxism is often portrayed as something very, like, something very last century, very kind of outdated and bogus and all mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But what it really does is it sets a foundation for understanding why oppression happens and what can be done about it. And I do think that, like, you know, that fundamental core, that, like, the mode of production at work characterizes pretty much anything that happens in a given society, like, including, you know, issues of colonialism, imperialism, family structures, the way that resources are used, which can lead to climate catastrophe, as Rowan had said, you know, all these things are intrinsically linked, mm-hmm. and one has to bring together all these different struggles under a particular, like, concentrated force, and that is, you know, the revolutionary agenda that we've got at work right here, and that's what Marxism seeks to articulate. So, yeah, hopefully that makes sense.
Do you happen to have that quote on
I
you,
am
Evelyn?
Actually looking for it right now. Okay, I found the quote, actually. So, as a blue-collar... Oh, this, by the way, is from Lavender and Red, part 84. We can go over that later when we cover Feinberg's legacy, but in any case, as a blue-collar lesbian butch, I had survived growing up in the 1950s Cold War ideological and state witch hunt against communists and militants, against same-sex love, and against any body or gender expression that sketched outside the lines of 1950s Dick and Jane gender education. If I had been taught anything at all about Marxism in my high school classes, it's that the worldview was dogma, moldering and hoary with irrelevance, and that factory workers like me wouldn't be able to understand a word of it. But in these pages, I found my life, my love, my class, and a genuine basis for solidarity with everyone battling oppression here and around the planet, and a materialist compass that pointed the direction toward liberation.
I really love that quote.
Yeah.
Applause.
So, yeah, I think we, maybe we should move on to the next question, unless anyone has anything else to add about how they became a communist. I didn't really say on my part why, but I do feel like it's like what you said, Rowan. There isn't really much of a choice.
Yeah.
The world is dying, and we know, like, a centrally planned economy would be pretty good at managing scarcity.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, because, like, I remember before, like, sort of, you know, the characteristics of Marxism in different areas, like, there used to be kind of a more utopian Marxism back in the 1960s and all that, which typically our parents will remember.
Right.
And in their case, it was like, for them, it was like, socialism was like revolution would happen tomorrow kind of thing. That was the way they were often thinking. And of course, that didn't really happen. But they also tended to look at socialism basically as a way of making society better. And today, it's like, we're at a point where we look at socialism kind of as a way to make society not fall the fuck apart.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if we want to live, we have to become socialist now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess on to the next question. What's it like being an LGBTI communist? So I guess in my experience, it's been both really cool and... in a lot of ways, not so cool. And not even because, like, I don't like being myself. I love who I am. But it's a community. I shouldn't say it's one community. You know, the, communists aren't a monolith. They differ in their beliefs based on country, based on party affiliation. And sometimes there are organizations that aren't as... friendly towards transgender people. I'm really happy and proud that the YCL Canada and the Communist Party of Canada is really good towards LGBT people. I received nothing but respect at the national convention, and we outlined transphobia as a clear breach of the code of conduct in both organizations. So, I mean, there are certain ways it's bad, and it's mostly online. It's not even in my own organization. It's like we deal with people who are like vulgar materialists, and they'll be like, well, you know, trans people, that's not materialist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, right?
Or they're like, Stalin killed all the trans people. Why are you a communist?
And I know. That one's always the worst.
Yeah, that's the other way. Yeah, that's the inverse of the whole thing.
I'm going to insult your beliefs. You know, here's why you should listen to me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, yeah, like, if gay people are murdered all the time in other in socialist countries, fag. Like, you know, thanks.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, I guess that's it for me. What do you got, Rowan?
What do I... Honestly, since I'm kind of new to this, sometimes I feel like a walking stereotype of, like, what a boober conservative's nightmare is. Like, transsexual communists are taking over our country. So...
Oh, my God. That reminds me of a Not the Onion news article from a few years back. And it was, like, some, like, Bible Belt pastor in the U.S., said that if you let your children go to public school, by the time they're 20, they'll be transgender and communist. That sounds pretty sweet, well. But it's not true.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Evelyn, you got anything?
Sure, yeah. Like, I mean, it's funny, because, like, of course, if, you know, like... Like, all these kinds of conspiracy theories that, like, Jordan Peterson and his ilk end up going on about, and about, like, you know, transgender Marxists infiltrating academia, and they all have interests.
I wish. There's, like, two.
Thing.
It's you and me.
Exactly, exactly. They don't even actually exist, but boy, if they, like, you know, I certainly would be convenient to Jordan Peterson under the circumstances.
I love it. Conservatives threatening us with a good time again.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, no, like, yeah, no, I mean, like, it's one of those things, like, those kinds of people who do, like, so much of the time I talk about how, hey, I'm a communist and da-da-da-da, and people are just baffled because they kind of associate, like, communism with just all this kind of stuff that's just, like, horribly oppressive all over the place, and, of course, it's the same thing with, like, homophobia and transphobia and whatever, like, instead of blaming all kinds of factors that might have been at work in socialist countries, they blame the concept of socialism itself, even though at the time that these things were going on, the exact same shit, if not worse, was going on in capitalist countries. Like, so it's not...
I know, it's really ridiculous. Yeah. And especially, it shows me the lack of education some people have about communism. Like, you know, we're all communists here. We've read Marxist literature. I don't remember the part where Karl Marx is like, workers of the world unite, persecute the gays.
Definitely did not happen.
Yeah. No, I haven't seen sexuality mentioned in, like, any Marxist theoretical work.
I mean, really. Ostensibly, and I've seen a lot of people use the origin of the family, private property, and the state as kind of a support for a lot of... Well, I've actually seen it used both for and against LGBTQ+ liberation struggle. Like, so it's kind of a weird thing, like, because there are definitely different interpretations of this whole thing, but I don't think that they're very strong ones for the notion that Marxism just contradicts these kinds of, like, struggles at all. In fact, if anything, locating these kinds of issues of cisnormativity and heteronormativity in the way that, like, capitalism hegemonically reproduces these strict family roles and whatever, like, for the sake of pretty much just regulating the way that weak people, like, fuck and give birth, you know, like, that doesn't actually do very much like, I guess another big thing is, like, from the other side, with the Marxists who are anti-trans rather than the you know, ostensibly, well, the capitalists who just tell us that Marxism won't help us kind of thing. With these kinds of Marxists who are against trans people, who are trans exclusionary and whatever, a lot of the time their idea sort of comes down to this notion that, like, gender itself is an ideological construct, which it is, and that, like, trans people kind of reify it through, like, defining themselves in accordance with one or another, like, kind of gender other than the one that they were assigned at birth. And I think that, like, these people need to start maybe talking to trans people, like, before they start, like, making judgments of that sort, because, like, you've talked to trans people, and every single one of them knows that it's an ideological, like, construct, aside from certain ones. Like, I would say that in, especially in situations where, like, people just don't have a whole, they just sort of have felt a particular way for a certain amount of time, and it's like, I'm this gender, and that's all that they can really make heads or tails mm-hmm. of right there. Yeah, that can sound like a gender essentialist argument, but, like, I think that there's a lot more going on right there than this notion that, like, it just comes down to people, like, feeling one or another gender, and mm-hmm. sort of making Absolutely. The whole thing metaphysical. Yeah.
So I think one thing that I always thought was a really good argument against it, like, people who say, oh, that's a social construct, I don't need to respect this. Mm-hmm. Mm. Traffic laws. Very good, like, very much a social construct.
But if you don't obey them, you're going to get hit by a car.
Yeah.
And that has material... It's social construct with material consequences.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, I mean, so is gender. Fuck, you don't do gender according to, like, you know, according to cisnormative, like, kind of sensibilities, and there's a very good chance that you'll get kicked out of the house by your parents and wind up starving on the street, so, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's also why... there's been so much of an influx in recent years of, like, LGBTI people becoming communists, you know? As I don't know about both of you, it's probably the same, but most of my friends who are trans are poor. Some of them have to sell their bodies to, like, pay the rent or get pay the rent and pay for hydro. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really bad out there. And when things get bad, people look for alternatives. And in that case, this alternative is socialism.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost, it's not so much an alternative so much as it is a solution, you know? Like, because what the heck else are you going to do?
That's true.
All right.
Isn't there actually, like, one official communist party? Is it the Britain one that has a stance that's, like... transphobic.
CPGB.
That would be... So, I want to make sure we're clear on it, that that's CPGBML.
Yep.
Okay.
And it's not CPB.
Yeah.
Which is
They're
actually
very different.
A fraternal party to ours. They're very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is what you mean about communists not being, like, a monolith, though.
Oh, absolutely. It's like, there's so many parties, and in other countries in the world, there, like in Turkey, there's, like, way more than 5 parties that are communist. In India, there's probably, like, 100 different communist parties.
I was thinking India. India has, like, you know, you could forget, like, Pokemon, like, gotta catch them all with the number of communist parties there are.
Mm-hmm. Though India, too, they're, like, the Communist Party of India Marxist has been, like, a really good example for trans rights under communist parties, like, in communist party policies, because, like, they're not in a socialist state, they're in capitalist India, but they run in the elections, and when they win, they can offer people, you know, social democratic reform, while also building the movement for socialism, and in some cases... they've been really successful, like, electing the first transgender judge in India, and also creating provisions so that trans people can have... Now, it isn't enough money to cover sexual reassignment surgery, but they have government funds that they distribute to trans people to help them cover that. And India...
For healthcare?
For healthcare. And also, India doesn't have any sort of socialized healthcare system in place on a federal level. Hmm. So, like, that's even... it's even better. But that's, like, a topic that I would have to research a lot on, like, the history of healthcare in India.
Yeah, no, I can't say I'm incredibly familiar myself.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting looking into the history of, like, different LGBTI people who were communists. Yeah, I know you mentioned Frida Kahlo at one point.
Yeah. There's one who a lot of people, of course, both overlook and maybe also sometimes tokenize.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of discourse about her recently.
Yeah. It is kind of confusing, the discourse. Because at the same time... I don't even know.
I don't even want to get into it, yeah. No, I just heard there's a lot of discourse that people are like, she's not good, she is good, she's not as good as you thought she was, or et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, I feel like the whole, like, Frida Kahlo is problematic because she made vaguely illegitimate claims to indigeneity thing. I think that it's a weak
argument. That's what it is.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty weak argument, personally. I also don't think it's incredibly relevant to her, like, legacy one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't even know that much about her as a historical figure, so I can't really say one way or another. Wasn't she also, like, a volunteer fighter during the Spanish Civil War?
I have no idea.
Someone
here should know their history.
Someone here should really know that.
Thankfully, the topic of today's podcast is not on Frida Kahlo.
Yeah, good. So. I'm sure there'll be someone who will comment and be like, you were wrong about this. This is what I think about
Frida Kahlo. Yeah, and you know what? To all the people who want to comment that someone said anything wrong, go for it. I'm not a dogmatist. I'm willing to learn and change my position.
I think wrong all the time.
Yeah.
I love being wrong.
I like that. I like that one meme that's like, I'm so into dialectics, I'm constantly in conflict with myself from 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
What was it like? Who is a coward and a fool or something? Yeah.
Yes, something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so we've gone over the fourth point. So, the fifth point was, what are some examples of communist organizing you have done in the LGBTI community?
Nice.
So, I can talk a bit about that because this will be our third year in... the Communist Party of Canada in London, Ontario, is registered for the Pride Parade. So we're going to be marching and handing out anti-pipeline literature and telling people about the connections between TD Bank, which is sponsoring the parade, and the pipelines that are going up. And I'm sure, Rowan, you might have more to say about that.
I mean, no, you summarized it
pretty well. Okay, good. I feel like I was just missing out some details on that.
No, it's basically we're going there to to make people critical of rainbow capitalism. So we're participating in rainbow capitalism in a way, but as a way to make people critical and aware of it.
So I guess besides that, 3 years of Pride, which has been really useful, as I said previously, in getting our name out there. And showing people in my city that there's a visible communist presence of people who aren't afraid to identify openly as communists, which is part of like what we really, I believe, really need to be pushing for. Because like, if we're all hiding online in chat rooms, we're not going to influence anyone.
Yeah, you're not organizing. And,
yeah, you're not. And I do see that. Sometime where political ideologies become personalities rather than actually like enacting the principles of those ideologies.
Yeah.
people who identify as Leninists who don't know the principles of Leninism. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, I'm also not trying to come down hard on people. You know, everyone starts off somewhere. I guess it's just when those people take center stage that it's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and also
I think terrible online leftists.
One big thing mm-hmm. is to kind of like bring, you know, we should be bringing kind of like the party discipline and whatever into the general public, not letting that kind of like very online kind of leftism screw with what we end up having going on inside of organizations. I think that that's a big priority right here, is like kind of just like introduce to people the fact that you can get stuff mm-hmm. done, but you have to go outside of just sort of sectarian infighting and like dumb memes on the internet if you're going to make that happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, why I'm drawn to the Communist Party, because they seem like they have their shit together. Like, there's an actual plan here. Yeah. There is that sort of party discipline. I like the YCL for that reason, because it kind of, like, trains you up in that discipline.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like a, historically speaking, the Young Communist League has always been, like, a launching pad for people to get involved in the Communist Party. Even though they're, and there's a lot of confusion about that. They are separate organizations with their own separate leadership and separate bank accounts. Like, yeah. It's not the Youth League of the Communist Party of Canada.
Despite
but
what some
ideologically...
people might tell you.
Yeah, people will tell you that. I think even on the Wikipedia page, it says something along the lines of the YCL is the youth wing, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's very close, and like even the current leader of the Communist Party of Canada, Elizabeth Rowley, was formerly a leader in the Young Communist League in her youth.
There's usually a bunch of overlap in membership, too.
Yeah.
Like, I personally am not part of the Communist Party, but I am part of the YCL. Mm-hmm. I could just only take on so many duties, you know?
So, but I think I digressed a bit. I talked about Pride London, but those are my only experiences so far with organizing, specifically communist organizing in the LGBTI community.
I have very little examples of that, again, because I haven't done a whole bunch. I will have more to say after we have our Pride Parade here, and I actually participate in that.
Yeah.
That'll be some organizing. But Evelyn does a lot more of this.
Oh, and anyone listening right now, feel free to come into London, Ontario next month for the Pride Parade. I'll have more information on my personal Facebook and Twitter. You can follow it at Clara Sorrenti. Or just look up Clara Sorrenti on Facebook.
You can
come
even
have a
join
gay
us.
Old communist time with us.
Yeah.
No, you can actually like march with us. It's a cool way to like get involved and like.
Yeah, I love meeting new people.
Yeah. No, I actually we had a few people from outside the party, like marching with us in Toronto. Shout out to Mel in Guelph, who joined in after I gave them an invitation literally the day before. They were like, heck yeah. So yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, Evelyn. How was Pride Toronto with the Communist Party?
Oh, I mean, it's always great. I freaking love it. Like, okay, you know, this is actually what I was going to say earlier, but then I got, like, interrupted because of that phone thing that was going on, was that, like... You know, I think that one of the reasons that Pride is so effective is because it's political, yes, but it's also kind of a celebration at the same time. It's a political celebration. Now, I mean, sometimes there has been an effort to turn it into a kind of a commodified celebration that doesn't have that involved, but, like, that's how you can often get people involved and also boost morale and stuff like that. Fact is that at the end of the day, we can't all just be sort of diehard, like... you know, iron-fisted revolutionaries at all times. We need to have something, like, especially given the austerity and bleakness of our everyday existence, that can, like, kind of give us the energy to get stuff done at the same time as getting stuff done. You know, because I went out there, I got in people's face. I mean, like, remember in Stratford, like, the one, you know, business bear who came up to us and was like, Black Lives Matter is bad, actually. Well,
so I think we got to back up a bit, because
The
podcast listeners won't know what we're talking about with the bear in Toronto.
I guess I'm trying to give an example, but basically, yeah, we, Like, so Stratford is this small place. It's like 40,000 people, but it's like where I grew up, and it also has a unique communist history that I will not currently get into because I've been tangenting enough already. But like, it's, you know, it's a small place. It's relatively, at least, like, kind of on the surface level, it's pretty progressive. Its actual politics are a fair bit more conservative, but like, you know, you go there and there's a lot of, you know, sort of very hippie-ish kind of artists sort of people and all that because it's a theater town. But in any case, when we were there organizing for the Pride Parade, one of our comrades who we had there was wearing a sticker saying Black Lives Matter, supporting Black Lives Matter. And this guy, like, sort of came up to us and started, like, going off about how back in 2017, it was either 2016 or 2017, something happened on both those days, years. I don't know which of it
he was referring to Black Lives Matter in Toronto when they stopped the parade.
Yeah.
So yeah, that would have been 2017 in that case.
That's when I was there.
But I mean, they did act in 2016 as well. But in any case, and he basically saw it as like, or at least he was putting it across as an attack on kind of like Pride itself, and like, you know, he was saying, oh, it's not their movement, and da da da, and that's exactly the point. Like,
yeah,
it is their movement as much as, like, you know, as much as, if not more than, like, any white gays.
Yeah,
absolutely. Out there. Like,
yeah, he makes it sound, know, like, so it much was of just the, like, a bunch of, like, straight cisgender gay people
straight,
just like showing
straight
up.
Gay people.
I wouldn't be surprised if that guy just
straight,
thought that
cisgender, black
people were homophobic.
People. Yeah. He made it sound like no one there who was blocking the parade was LGBT, and this had nothing to do with it. But it's obvious that's like a racist perception.
Don't know how to tell you that intersectionality is a thing.
You can be black and gay.
Yeah wow. Newsflash.
Well, and I think that this is one of the key issues of, like, hegemony, is this thing where, like, we've got, like, all these, like, sort of interests sort of just being, like, pit against each other or, like, divided in such a way that you don't have a basis for, like, any kind of real movement against oppression. But, I mean, I think that this guy's also quite fuck you got mine about it because he ended up, like, sort of accosting me. Well, rather, I guess I accosted him, like, later on.
Oh, yeah, he was nasty to you.
And he called me a man, like, multiple times over, and so...
Yeah, these people
it was,
just
like,
turned to misgendering
in any
insulting.
Case, I think I've made
I
my
mean,
point.
I mean, just, like...
Yeah.
It's really sad. It's like, he's racist, he's transphobic.
Yeah.
But because he's gay, he's still showing up to these parades, and he's still trying to have his input heard.
Yeah.
Though, I don't know if people should hear his input. It doesn't sound like it's very good.
Certainly, I don't want to listen to it.
Well, I mean, I think there's a certain point where you've heard enough.
No, absolutely.
But in any case, yeah, to get back to the original point, because this has tangented a great deal. Toronto, like, yeah, no, like, I mean, I think that, you know, even when the... you're showing up at, like, at the more unpleasant parts of Pride, it's like you're also kind of having a good time. And then afterward you go and you can, like, sing and dance and, like, do whatever the heck that it is you do, and, like, you know, you are to an extent there to have a good time. There's nothing wrong with that.
Communism still,
you know,
involves building community, and that
involves
having a good time sometimes.
Yeah. Give people a reason to live.
I mean, that's also why, like, the YCL right now is trying to host Rebel Youth Festivals across cities in Canada sometime this summer. Because we've got to build, we need to build a socialist culture. Part of that is going to be having fun.
Yeah.
You can't build any sort of movement unless you can really...
I like how we're making out...
What?
Sorry. I like how we're making out having fun as, like, some.
We have to have fun.
No, like, I
now,
guys, we have to have fun sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, like, we need to do a lot of work.
I know it's not really what we're in here for.
Yeah,
but yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I just think that there are a lot of leftists out there who are unfortunately quite austere about this question, and they like they and for them it's like, you know, going and having like a drink with some comrades or whatever is like verboten. It's not something you do.
We're gonna have a YCL game night soon, aren't we?
Yeah, I thought we were doing something like
We should do that. It'll be fun.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like it's important to remember too, like you know, the key purpose of political organizations is to organize politically.
Mm-hmm.
But building connections between comrades in person is invaluable.
You have to build relationships with the rest of the community, too. Like, you can't just hang out with other comrades. And that's why places like Pride is a great space to build those greater relationships.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sometimes it can be a bit weird. I remember last year at the parade, someone gave a red salute and yelled, "Stalin did nothing wrong" at our floor.
Oh, I don't like that.
God!
Yikes. That's the part of, like, less of that. We need more party discipline and less of that.
Well, you know, they're not part of the party.
Yeah.
But the energy's nice. I just don't know about
the thought that counts. I appreciate the enthusiasm. Not so sure about anything else.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
No, it's funny. Okay. Yeah. Who knew you could have, like, nuanced answers to historical questions of that sort? But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, why have nuanced answers to historical questions when you can just do a bunch of hot takes?
That's how you get the likes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the retweets.
And do internet memes.
You just have the hottest, most batshit galaxy brain take. And that's what makes people pay attention.
Okay, so, like, Leslie Feinberg, like, I'm going to use Z here pronouns for her under the circumstances. Z actually used a whole bunch of different, like, pronouns for sort of different situations. But it, in any case, like, I mean, Feinberg was responsible for a lot of the kind of, for a lot of really early, like, kind of pro, you know, political transgender kind of stuff. If you go back to 1992, then you're dealing with, like, sort of trans liberation, a movement whose time has come, which was, like, published for the Workers' World Party, and kind of went over a lot of things to do with kind of, like, the history of sort of how gender does not really ever work in a fundamentally, like, predictable, like, sort of way, and that there have always been, like, aspects of oppression, anti-oppressive struggle to transgender struggle itself. Now, I mean, there are parts of it that are admittedly a bit anachronistic. I think that that would have been more and more clear as time went on. But, like, for the time, I think that it was, like, groundbreaking work, and it's definitely worth looking at. It also uses a very different definition of transgender from what we would typically use today, where in many ways it kind of has to do more with, like, sort of general nonconformity with gender norms, like extreme extreme rejection of those norms, in fact, than, like, some kind of a, you know, sort of the typical transgender definition used today. There are a lot of other examples of people using different definitions of transgender throughout history. I could think of a few, although the names aren't coming to me right now. I don't think that that's incredibly important because we're talking about communists right now. But anyway, the point is that, like, yeah, so 1992, you had transgender liberation. Then 1993, Stone Butch Blues, which was kind of like Feinberg's main kind of, like, contribution to queer lit, and the name, the book that most people will remember here for, from, it's funny too, because, like, it's one of those books that, like, you know, it sort of canonized Feinberg as this queer lit icon, but a lot of the time the communism part is sort of left out. So
and
it makes sense, of course.
I actually had a quote I wanted to bring up by Lenin because it incorporates both what we are talking about with Ashton.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I know the one you mean.
With Mark Ashton and Leslie mm-hmm. Feinberg and even like Che Guevara from the State and Revolution. During the lifetime of great revolutionaries, the oppressing classes constantly hounded them, received their theories with the most savage malice, the most furious hatred, and the most unscrupulous campaigns of lies and slander. After their death, attempts are made to convert them into harmless icons, to canonize them, so to say, and to hollow their names to a certain extent, for the consolation of the oppressed classes, and with the object of duping the latter, while at the same time robbing the revolutionary theory of its substance, blunting its revolutionary edge, and vulgarizing it.
Yeah, I had a feeling it was going to be that one.
Yeah, that accurately describes Motorcycle Diaries.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to this with just, like, sort of generally, like, memory as kind of this cultural thing. This is something that one of my profs mm-hmm. goes on about a lot, who's, like, also just wonderful, but, like, brings in a lot of the political aspects to this whole thing, is how, like, sort of cultural memory ends up being used as this political device, and it's one of those reasons, I think that right now mm-hmm. we have to be really careful of that with Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, that there are a lot of, you know, like, because there is supposed to be, like, statues going up of them now, and all that kind of thing, and I'm like, is, you know, like, sure, this can be a good thing, but is this also maybe also having that effect of turning them into kind of depoliticized cultural icons rather than, people who actually had a completely anti-status quo approach to things in the time that they were alive? And there's every reason to believe they still would, you know? Like,
yeah. And I mean, it's also important to ask who's putting the statues
Absolutely.
Up. Like, is it an effort of the city? Is it a private company?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and why are they doing that? Yeah. And if it is a company, what other activities are they up to that they're trying to hide by putting up these LGBT icons as statues?
Yeah, good questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And yeah, corporate activism is... That's something we got to point out all the time.
I'm so
tired of
it.
Banks can't be activist organizations, you know? General Dynamic Land Systems cannot be an activist organization. They make military vehicles.
But don't you know that the military vehicles are gay or something?
Yeah, so gay, they go to countries where they execute gay people.
Yeah.
I do want to kind of, like, mention is, since I brought up that, like, quote with, from Feinberg earlier about kind of like Marxism as it is received versus how it's portrayed like in schools and all that kind of thing. Like the work that Z's actually referring to right there is it's actually a work by Bob McCubbin called The Roots of Lesbian and Gay Oppression. He also worked with the Workers' World Party once upon a time. I think he actually still does, come to think of it. He still definitely...
It's hard to say. There was some issues I'm not going to get into during this podcast.
Okay.
We can talk about another
but
time.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, another sort of name, I guess, that's worth...
Mm-hmm. And didn't you say you had one, Rowan?
Oh, the... figure I was thinking of is he's more of like a social democrat. Edward Carpenter, he was a English poet from like the turn of the century. He was in relationship with George Merrill, who was working class man. They their relationship was the inspiration for E.M. Forrester's novel Maurice, or I think it's actually pronounced Morris, but yeah, so since I studied English Lit, that was kind of one of my initial introductions to socialism was through Edward Carpenter and his poetry. So.
I mean, that's fair, and everyone, like, gets, they come to communism through various ways,
oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, like, in my own party, our party, Norman Bethune is, like, a huge figure, even though he joined the party when he was in his, like, late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I appreciate that we don't canonize people for, like, the length that they're in the party, but for the merit of the work that they did while they were in the party.
Talk about, like, poetry and other kinds of things that are, like... Like, I mean, I can think... Like, there are a number of people where I'm not sure I would call them Marxists or not, but we're still, like, sort of important to LGBTQ plus thought, at least for me, and for, like, and whose ideas definitely kind of have relevance to a Marxist approach. Bruce Boone comes to mind, for instance, but, yeah.
So another figure that is lesser known that I think is worth mentioning is Francisco Rodriguez, who is a gay member of the Communist Party of Cuba. He has a blog anyone can read called Bikido de Cuba, and he talks about Cuban policy. He talks about being a gay man in Cuba. His most recent work was a lot of community engagement during the constitutional reform process in Cuba, because they were going to put same-sex marriage in the new constitution and ended up withdrawing it due to a lot of protest by reactionary forces on the island, like the Catholic Church and other, like, far-right religious organizations. That said, like, I have a quote from him, because he was, like, really urging people to get involved in this process. And it's kind of funny when people think communism, they're like, oh, politics is not open for debate. But if it wasn't open for debate, this wouldn't have been an issue, because the president backed same-sex marriage.
Right.
He said, I urge LGBTI people to engage in all the spaces of debate within our reach, so that our families, work groups, and neighborhoods know who we are and what we are worth, and why we consider this step to be just and revolutionary, even beyond our own particular well-being or benefit.
Nice.
So, like, you can see, like, even in Cuba, there are LGBT communists. I saw it when they did May Day. They even had a contingent of people from CENESEX, which is the Cuban National Center for Sex Education, which is headed up by Mariela Castro, who is the daughter of Raul Castro.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, and that is sort of a shame that there aren't as many figures
there
that we
probably
talk
are a
about.
Lot that
we,
we're
we
like
talked about Francisco Rodriguez,
honest,
we talked about Mark Ashton.
Yeah, mostly because
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Again, people can put it in the comments.
Oh, yeah. if you know a figure, an LGBTI communist that you think we missed out, just let us know in the comments. We will we'll bring it up. We
I
can
also
do another
want to
episode
mention,
on
like,
this
we
topic.
We kind of got
at
sidetracked while I was talking about Leslie Feinberg. But yeah, like, I talked briefly about transgender liberation, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. transgender warriors, Stone Butch Blues, all that. Zia actually had a lot of different works throughout her life, but one that gets plugged a lot, and probably rightly so, because it covers a lot of the kind of stuff that we've already been talking about with, like, you know, how there have been, like, you know, all kinds of about like sort of the history of the LGBTQ plus struggle in socialism. And, you know, of course, Lavender and Red focuses entirely mm-hmm. on that. And, you know, a lot of it is based on just, like, the fact that, like, you know, you can't look at... For one thing, like, lots of progress actually does end up being made in LGBTQ plus struggle under socialism. But, of course, there are problems that still arise. But, like... It's always kind of spurious to say that it's because of socialism that those things are occurring. When homosexuality was, like, you know, criminalized in the Soviet Union, it was done alongside a whole lot of, like, weird and kind of misplaced concerns about, like, sex trafficking. Like, I mean, real concerns that were going on in the USSR. But, like, that kind of, like, had this weird overlap. And you can still end up sort of seeing how a lot of people will try to use this notion that, like, you know, LGBTQ plus people are, like, sex criminals or whatever in all kinds of different areas. But the point is that that's ruling class ideology. That's not socialism. That's, like, the fact that even within socialism, there's a constant struggle to, like, wage against ruling class ideology. And when it comes right down to it, you know, Stalin was able to do a great deal, like, for, you know, the war effort and whatever during the 40s. But he was also, like, a guy who grew up in rural Catholic Georgia, like, inundated with ruling class ideology, and he acted on it. Like,
I mean, who would have figured that people born in the first half of the 20th century or earlier might have backwards views on sexuality? I mean, it's sad to say, you know, that it's really come a long way, even since when I was a kid. People's awareness of transgender people, even, like, before, you know, I just got called, like, a tranny, like, sorry, excuse the word, but people literally did not know that that was a slur. They thought that's what you would call a transgender person. And then it was, like, around the time, like, Caitlyn Jenner came out, and I'm sure we all have bitter feelings about her.
So many.
But I guess the one good thing she did is bring it into a more public discourse.
Well, she didn't do
that.
She just sort of did her own thing, and it became a discursive subject from there. It's not like she politicized it. It was just a subject that politicized itself.
I mean, yeah, she didn't, like, do it as much as she just, like, wrote on the publicity that being an Olympic medal winner and then coming out as trans gives you. But, like, I remember even my mom telling me before Caitlyn Jenner came out, when she would tell her coworkers about the fact I had sexual reassignment surgery, they would react baffled. They're like, what? That's a thing? You can do that?
And what?
Yeah. And now it's like, if she brings it up, they're like, oh yeah, I know what that is.
Yeah. Like, things have changed a lot in the past 10 years. I came out like 10 years ago, and it's radically different now.
And I hope it keeps getting more radically different in the future.
It feels like it is.
I think it will.
Okay. So do we have any more things to discuss on the example, on discuss about historical examples of LGBTI people who are communists?
None that I have right now.
Yeah, I've exhausted my own
list. You can find a lot of... If you read through Lavender and Red, you will find a lot of examples of that kind of thing. I would just recommend that people, like, read that, because you'll find other names through that if you want.
Absolutely. One book I wanted to read by Leslie Feinberg I haven't got around to yet was...
That's part of Lavender and Red.
Rainbow Solidarity in Defense of Cuba.
Yep. It's sort of a reworked part of the specific section about Cuba.
Well, with that said... thanks, everyone, for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We should do some, like, you know, we should plug our presences or whatever before we play out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if everyone wants to give their Twitter, I gave mine earlier.
Don't follow me on Twitter. That's my advice.
Okay.
If you don't want to learn about baking, don't follow Rowan.
It's just a bunch of tweets about how I'm gay.
You want to see Rowan's baked treats. I want to see Rowan's baked... I want to eat them. I'm looking forward to being in London next, just so that I can, like, have any of Rowan's
I need to make
baking,
you something.
I keep on seeing this stuff on Twitter.
I know, I need to make you something, like, extra chocolatey.
Yeah, because you know how I do in that way.
Yep.
Oh my god. But yeah, I am Sun Witch on Twitter. That's like Sun Witch, like as in with the pointed hat witch, but it's got two I's in it. So SUNWIITCH. And yeah, go ahead and, like, follow me there if you want. And also, like, if you see me around on Facebook, go ahead, like, send me a friend request. I'm friendly. I'm also, like, a massive, like, shit poster. Like, so just, you know.
I love your shit posts.
They're pretty entertaining. So
thank you.
I guess while we're plugging things, also check out The Communist Curd on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. We're constantly posting content, and we're going to be doing a podcast episode every month from here on out. So, yeah, give that a check. I mean, check that out.
Give that a check.
Yeah, okay, cool.
All right.
Are we done then?
I think we are.
Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Good night.